NFTs are just going to become so ubiquitous that we'll probably toss this word out, right? It's going to be everything. It's going to be each drawer that I have in the background. It's the chair I sit on. It's the mug that my character sips out of. It's their cool flames. It's their horns. You know, different glasses, different hair. Welcome to another episode of Inner Sphere. You've got your hosts here. I'm Graham.
And I'm Brian. Good to be back.
So excited to chat with you again, man. Last time we covered quite a few topics. I think this time around, we want to dive in a little bit deeper into one of the biggest things in the industry right now, NFTs. And there's really none better than...
Great, amazing question. So NFTs, I would say, are not very new. They are a technology standard on the Ethereum blockchain. And they have been around very much since the beginning. You know, I think if we want to just talk about like NFTs that people recognize, CryptoKitties are probably the original like craze on the Ethereum blockchain that showed what NFTs were. But even before that, I also would like to bring attention to something like ENS, which is something which is also built using NFT technology. And but it's not used in the same way that you see today, like a Bored Ape is an NFT, right? So we're probably going to get into like what that underlying technology really is. But definitely NFTs have been around for quite some time and have been a core innovation on blockchain.
Yeah, I actually think there's some on Bitcoin, Crypto Pepes, I believe.
Ooh.
Really Ooh. Old school stuff. But anyway, you lead me right into the next topic, which is that we're predominantly seeing them as a vehicle for art right now. Everyone's looking at them, right? It's a JPEG. Can I right click it? I think that's a great place to start, and then we'll begin to build off of it. But, you know, that's the most prominent version that we're seeing. And let's just chat about CryptoKitties for a second, because that was super interesting, right? That was maybe one of the first instances where the retail hype of collectability came onto blockchain. And maybe you remember this, but it actually crashed Ethereum, right?
Oh, 100%. I was there. I was minting and breeding cats. I was collecting cats. I just kind of wish CryptoKitties like had the same level of prestige as CryptoPunks, because if they did, I'd be super rich. but yes, I will say that CryptoKitties, you know, to your point, yes, they were the first kind of, I want to say, this might be a hot take, but like one of the first killer apps on the Ethereum blockchain, right? Some might say the first killer app was ICOs, you know, and the next one probably is CryptoKitties, because it literally took down the Ethereum blockchain with the sheer amount of transaction volume of people minting cats, buying cats, breeding cats, selling, listing, all of that stuff. And all of it was done on chain. And the key innovation here is that these cats were all digitally unique. And each digitally unique cat was represented as a NFT token on the Ethereum blockchain. So that whenever, if you have one cat and it's backed by this NFT, there is literally no other cat out there that is like that. I would also like to add that, you know, yes, unique stuff is cool, but like what's really powerful here is that it's like provably unique, and it's like backed by the database, which is the Ethereum blockchain. So for people that are collectors, right, people that collect baseball cards or people that collect anything really, like you want to know that what you're collecting is authentic and is rare. And those are literally the two major things. Yes, provenance. You want to know that where it's coming from is the original source. You want to be able to prove that by looking at the source data, which in this case is the blockchain data that you can view by going on a block explorer like Etherscan. And then you then have confidence that the thing that you own is in fact real and rare. So that's, I guess, like the innovation of CryptoKitties, and one of the first times that people really like got to see that visually and experience it. So I got a bunch of cats. I don't know, Graham, if you have any cats, but maybe our cats should mate.
Ooh, I'm actually kittenless. But
you had some IRL cats, though. I remember that.
That totally came out of a time when people were really just selling white papers and ideas, right? A lot of back of napkin kind of hypotheses. And really, there wasn't even any use case at that point in time. Everyone was chasing utility. So these NFTs dropped. They actually had a purpose, which people will argue against it over and over again. Is a digital image a true valuable piece of utility, et cetera, et cetera? I think anybody that has young kids nowadays will tell you that, you know, what they're asking for Christmas are generally game skins, some sort of digital collectible, because let's be honest, it's a post-COVID era. People are hanging out in digital worlds. They want to show themselves off, express themselves. I mean, you know, to simplify it, I'm kind of like, it's the Abercrombie and Fitch of, you know, a metaverse platform or a MMORPG game, right?
I love that. Exactly. I mean, I totally feel that, you know, it's the people maybe are just like, I think that they're oversimplifying or maybe underappreciating like how passionate collectors are for things. You know, if you find a community of people that are passionate about collecting things, they are passionate. So if there's a way for this community to like gather digitally, you know, in a borderless way on a decentralized platform where the ownership is owned by the network and the users themselves, like that's super powerful. And this kind of goes back to just like an overarching benefit of blockchain technology. Like there is no middleman here. You're interacting directly with the source, and the artists directly benefit, and the community is like transparently seeing what's happening. So huge innovations happening all around on the NFT front.
And you know, there's something I've also noticed. Like I take my sister into account here, as she's got her young kids, right? So lots of photos of everybody. And what used to be a world where people would really print photography, maybe hang it into frames, I'm starting to see screens pop up over and over again. And you know, the Facebook feed is a very rich piece of content. You can get the time, you know, remember when 5 years ago you did XYZ. And there's this really amazing effect of scrolling through a variety of images. And I think NFTs are just very parallel in my mind. You know, I'm a photographer. I've done a lot of large prints. Honestly, they're delicate. They're massive. When you move, it's like, okay, what do I do with this thing? And then in the era of digital photos, it's like, you know what, maybe I'd actually just like my flat screen to beautifully fold into the aesthetic of my house and just like rotate images. If it's got a high enough resolution, then like, anyway, I find that to be very cool. And that extends to the power of these things as an artist. So I've got a couple friends, illustrators, they're doing a really great job. I would say that NFTs actually very much require a network, right? So a lot of people that were building a fan base on Instagram were never able to monetize this kind of thing. Suddenly it was like, oh, you like me, you want to support me as an artist. Now there's an opportunity to not only be able to cop it, and obviously you could rip it off of Instagram, but like, that's not really cool. Let's be real. That's not ownership of art. Whereas going out and actually purchasing an NFT of somebody you like, not only are you getting the capital back into a creative, so they can hopefully, you know, feed themselves and pay their rent, but you now suddenly have true ownership. You can hold on to this thing. You can say, this one's mine. Maybe there's a couple like it, but you know, generally a lot of people are doing one at once. So, yeah. You know, I think it's a really cool pivot forward. I personally don't have a very difficult time grasping the right click save thing. And then, as you know very well, when you explore in the markets, like, right click save doesn't allow you to also participate in secondaries, which is a game in and of itself, right? And that sort of exactly. Leads me to the next point. Brian, I would love it if you could lead us into like, what do the secondary markets look like here, right? If you could like cover some of the drops that we've seen, the growth, like what makes them actually start to be tradable or desirable? Take it away, brother.
Yeah, great question, man. Secondary markets are where it's at, honestly, right, with NFTs. And I do, you know, I'm going to ask you a question in a little bit because I know you have personal experience in the secondary markets with your own artwork. So like, as we get into that, I would say one of the major benefits of these non-fungible tokens, these NFTs, is that they can be listed for sale on a secondary market. You know, the biggest secondary market out there is OpenSea. There's also places like Rarible and Super Rare and Looks Rare and things like that, where you can just kind of like put up your NFTs for sale. The interesting part about this, and this is like what, when I talk to people that are not in crypto, these are just my friends, just people that are just talking about random stuff and they're not like working in the crypto industry. The thing that always gets their ears to perk up is when I mention that for NFTs, the creator of the art can receive a percentage of secondary sales in perpetuity, which is really, really powerful. And this is kind of where I want to hand this off to you again, Graham, because you know, you are clearly a distinguished photographer. You've done a lot of stuff in that industry. I want to, I guess, hear your personal perspective on selling photos on as NFTs, and maybe perspectives that you heard from your creative friends that have also maybe made art or other photographers, and like how they feel about that. And does that change the way they approach their profession?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, generally in the creative space, a lot of people are very talented at their craft. That doesn't mean you can market yourself very well or you can run the business side. So I can't tell you how many people I know that are extremely talented, but don't know how to ask for a respectable rate, or how to necessarily generate, you know, a meaningful amount of capital to live their lives. And this is a true game changer. Now, like, you know, it's kind of interesting because we're talking about taking those royalty payments and putting it, let's just say, back into my own pocket, right? I created the thing, you know, for the rest of the time, even after I'm dead, maybe these royalties go to the family, maybe it goes to like a family trust, all sorts of interesting hypotheses. But we've also seen a lot of groups coming together to sort of coordinate, and those royalties can build a treasury, right? And we're starting to see projects take that because the secondary market starts to become pretty frothy, right? The velocity of trades picks up, more of that's happening, and an increased value capture comes back to the actual creator of the asset. And then they can use this to maybe launch more product, to do real life events, to actually build and launch a business. So for example, I know people that do it with clothing, right? And they've used it in their clothing sales, and now these royalties kind of allow them to buy new machines, to buy manufacturing floors where they can actually work rather than working out of their apartment bathroom, right? And then of course that scales up to, as people get more sophisticated, and we're seeing like Bored Ape Yacht Club is really starting to build an entire ecosystem out of what they've been able to capture from this royalty flow. So again, like, you know, don't think limited. It doesn't have to be a one-on-one. Obviously artists can capture a lot of value if they're creating it, but there's all sorts of business opportunities that can open up, and you get to retain this stream of revenue, which is truly what it is. I mean, that's what's really amazing, right? You open up this digital, highly transactional asset, and obviously the fluidity of blockchain as payment rails gets you this revenue flow that just lasts forever. So that's pretty mind blowing. And it definitely allows people to get creative in order to, you know, grow, to scale, to augment. A lot of people are shifting because they're like, whoa, now we have a capital base that we can work with. We can think new ideas, and we can move on that. But, you know, all that being said, I think that takes us into a further step, which is that, you know, Brian, are NFTs limited to art?
Yeah, man, that's a big one. Clearly the answer is no, right? So NFTs are definitely skyrocketed into popularity because of the use case for art. And art is a medium for culture. And culture is mass media, and it's like the way you reach the masses, which is amazing, by the way, not knocking that at all. And I think that's really big for the industry that we found a use case that like resonated with everybody. But, you know, back to like, maybe we get to the technological roots here of what NFTs are, and how powerful that is, you know? So NFTs at its core, you know, it stands for non-fungible token. And what that means is that these tokens are not interchangeable with each other, which means that, you know, my CryptoKitty and my second CryptoKitty cannot be, they're not the same value because they have slightly different properties. And this is a stark contrast to something like Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is considered fungible. And what that means is if I have a Bitcoin and you have a Bitcoin and we trade each other Bitcoin, that doesn't really change anything. We still have one Bitcoin each. So that is the main difference between a fungible token and a non-fungible token. Now knowing that, right, knowing that you now have a way to digitally represent scarcity or digitally represent uniqueness, you can see how that's popular for digital art, because there's, you can now fight counterfeiting. This is what we just talked about. But there's also other use cases here where, you know, maybe you have your digital identity represented on blockchain, represented as an NFT, right? Like, there's only one Brian, there's only one Graham. So like, we are not fungible. Maybe we could be. That'd be kind of cool. We're fungible, but like, you know, we're not necessarily fungible. You can't just like put me into your house. Yeah, not there yet. So because of that, like, identity is a great mix for a great recipe for NFTs, or the example I set in the beginning, which was ENS, right? Ethereum Naming System. This is a way for you to represent your MetaMask wallet or your wallet address on the Ethereum blockchain with like a human readable name. So for example,
like an email, right?
It's like an email. It's exactly like an email, but there's a one-to-one relationship between your ENS name and your blockchain address. And that is a non-fungible thing. You can't just switch my ENS name with your ENS name. So this is obviously another great use case for NFTs. So I think that we're still scratching the surface on what we can do with NFTs. Like, other things that come to mind for me are like titles of homes, voting, concert tickets. You know, concert tickets have like seats assigned to them. They only work for one concert, not the second concert. So like, there's other applications that are currently explored today where NFTs represent, you know, these like kind of unique experiences. And yeah, we're just literally scratching the surface. I don't know. Is there anything you want to add there, Graham? I think you probably see a few others on your end as well, as far as use cases for NFTs.
Yeah, I mean, does our future live on the internet? Like, very strongly. Obviously, I think that answer is yes. We're doing that now. We are currently beaming through the internet. Again, the post-COVID era moved us into a work from home. And therefore, our identities and our presences are there. And that's how we want to show it off. So one of the earliest NFTs as well is called POAP, Proof
of Attendance Protocol.
Thank you. Okay, perfect. Brian nailed it. But they're super cool. You go to an event, you scan it, it stays in your wallet forever. It's a little heirloom, right? Now, like, why is that cool? It's just a little notch on your belt, whatever. But inside a crypto wallet, that means that anybody that wants to target that user base can literally look at the blockchain, the truth meter that records everything, and say, hey, man, I actually want to launch a new project and I want to distribute it to people that only have POAPs from event X, let's say Graham concert. And that allows me to target and really specifically, you know, angle my marketing campaigns directly at these people. Conversely, I could go the other way. I could say I have this VIP event, could be a club, like IRL, right, in real life, could be digital. And the way that you enter is you open your wallet and you show that you actually have this NFT in there. We're seeing that happen with the art pieces as well, because they become communities. So we're seeing chat apps develop where your NFT gets you into the chat. I mean, Twitter just did it, right? It proves that your handle actually owns that NFT. This starts to unlock all sorts of gamification potential. Maybe you get one NFT, it drops you another one. If you have two of those NFTs, it gets you to a third. Supreme has been like pretty good at doing all of this, right? If you get swag drops, all sorts of stuff of that nature. But that's kind of the building that we're seeing, is token gated access. The beauty of a blockchain is we have these things called Merkle trees. It's basically a giant branching tree of all transactions and everything that happens. And you can literally follow a Merkle path. So if Brian and I wanted to launch a company, and this actually recently happened, right, with OpenSea, which is a massive marketplace. What are they doing? Billions of dollars of revenue. It's like utterly insane. And another competitor wanted to launch. So they went to all of the users of OpenSea and they airdropped them an asset. This was a fungible token in this case. But in order to claim it, you had to go to their marketplace, put an NFT up for sale or interact with it, right? Onboard users. This is a user acquisition play. but you can do it by targeting specific owners. We call this a vampire attack in the industry, and it's actually a very, very cool thing. Exactly. Ah. And one of the key differences that we see in Web3 that is a little bit different from the traditional business model is that you're actually giving away value as your market spend, right? Your ad spend is, hey, let me give away this thing that represents ownership. Let's just call it as close to equity as you can get, but tokens are very different. But I can distribute that ownership straight to you. I don't have to pay ads. I don't have to get on Times Square. I can drop this thing in your wallet. You open it up, you say, oh, this is cool. And they're like, yes, to engage with us or to claim those tokens, come to our platform, jump through a few hoops, become a user, and boom, you've taken somebody else's community and you've onboarded them to yourself. So we're seeing all of this really dynamic play kind of roll out, and it's been truly interesting. So, you know, the example I just described was LooksRare, which is a competitor to OpenSea, and they use this exact tactic.
And just to add on top of that, like, you know, Graham, you mentioned that they spent money by basically giving away, you know, the equivalent of equity in their company to get users, but they are also making money based on the secondary sales of these NFTs, right? So like, this is like a huge, it's an investment on their side, but it's been paying off, right? So LooksRare has, you know, market activity, and whenever an NFT sells on LooksRare, there's a portion of that sale that goes to LooksRare, and also there's a portion of the sale that goes to the original NFT creator that we mentioned before. So huge play by LooksRare. We should really have a podcast episode just on vampire attacks, literally one of my favorite things in all of crypto. So I also want to add one point that I want to just like make clear for myself or other people that are listening is that NFTs are typically, you know, they are non-fungible, and they usually represent like digitally unique things. But it's also important to note that you can mint multiple of an NFT as well. So what I'm thinking here is like video game weapons, right? Say that you're playing Halo and there's only 100 of these like energy swords or something like that out there, plasma swords, I forget what they're called. Basically there's 100 of them. So you mint 100 NFTs of that, of which those 100 actually are somewhat fungible, you know, because they can be interacted with each other. But within that set of 100, they are unique. There is no other plasma sword outside of that 100. So like, that is also another application of NFTs. And it also serves to make these swords rare, but they're not one of one rare, they're one of 100 rare, which is still pretty rare. So there's still like different ways you can play around with NFTs. And we're just literally scratching the surface, as I've been saying, on what we can do with these with this technology. And like, you know, games are gonna go crazy with this.
Yeah, actually, a lot of the games we're seeing right now are blending NFTs and fungible tokens, right? So maybe you do get one of the 100 swords, but as you accrue more of the fungible asset, you can spend it to level up said sword. So now, just because there's 100 doesn't mean that, you know, yours and mine are existing at the same level, because let's say Brian puts in like 100 hours and completely slays me, right? Yeah. Then your sword is going to become much more desirable. You can sell it on the market. We've seen this with gun skins. You know, the last time around, I remember learning about the gun skin market in Canada. It was two guys that were trading Call of Duty gun skins, basically through like standard rails. There wasn't a smooth way to do it. There was a lot of bit of trust involved. So they were basically an escrow service, but they were doing, I think, $1 million a week in gun skin sales. So again, this was like well before NFTs. This was just based off of the existing applications, and people found a way to make a market. So now you're taking the financial rails of blockchain, and you're allowing these markets to actually become something much more robust. No escrow middleman, right? Like LooksRare is just a smart contract. And they maintain it. So it's a protocol. It's not actually a business. This is where crypto gets really interesting. Now, the one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, NFTs are probably going to expand well beyond these collectibles, beyond even the concept of, you know, this thing that I buy on the marketplace. As we do go into a metaverse, right, chances are, I think people will want to have ownership of their room, of their place. Let's say this mug that I have here and this sweater that I wear. If I want them to be recurring objects in a digital world, those will probably be NFTs that sit inside my wallet. Every time I load up that world and the servers spin it up and they start to render this place, it will scan my wallet and it will be like, oh, this is the object permanence layer of the metaverse. These are things that keep consistently loading with my profile being my wallet. And I honestly think NFTs are just going to become so ubiquitous that we'll probably toss this word out, right? It's going to be everything. It's going to be each drawer that I have in the background. It's the chair I sit on. It's the mug that my character sips out of. It's their cool flames. It's their horns, you know, different classes, different hair sets.
I totally agree. And I love when you say that NFTs are the object permanence layer of the metaverse. You know, that's like, it encapsulates it so well. You know, like for those of you that have seen Ready Player One, or read Ready Player One, they're everything that's in there, right? All the cars, all the weapons, all your items, like that in, if we were to recreate that today, all those things will be represented by NFT technology. That is the only way that you can provably own something in the digital world. So that's how powerful this technology is, you know? Yeah, you can have like a cool, like, you know, piece of art hanging in your room. That's an NFT in the metaverse, but you can also represent your completely modded out car with all of its like upgraded horsepower and wheels and everything. That's also NFTs. So this technology really has a very large range of application, especially when you start thinking about metaverses, and especially when you start thinking about the generation of people that are going to be, that are born today, that will probably spend a lot of time in the metaverse, and their concept of ownership and the value that they place on digital ownership may exceed the value that they place on things in the physical world. So that is definitely a huge potential for NFT technology, and like super excited to see it like transform and what people are going to do with it.
Yeah. You know, everything you mentioned there really resonates with me as the core purpose of what blockchain technology is, which is to re-envision and rebuild our understanding of value. We talk about money a lot. Brian's heard me say this. I think the word is actually going to disappear at some point in time because, you know, currently we use a paper note as just an exchange of energy, right? You put your energy out, you went to your job, you did stuff. You've got that energy contained in a note. Note's not even backed by anything anymore, right? But a lot of people will take that money and they'll just go to their game world where they're the most comfortable. That's where their friends live. That's where their character has been powered up through hundreds of hours of gameplay. And in the future, according to blockchain, you know, if you prefer to get your value generated there, you'll probably be moving it in that direction. And if you prefer your value to go elsewhere, let's say into a music collection of your favorite artist, you know, we're starting to see a lot of music NFTs start to pop up. And again, that's really cool. That's taking out the middleman. And, you know, we're looking at sort of a very interesting moment in time right now where big record labels are kind of, you know, unnecessary. We had Macklemore, who just went straight to market, right? Monetized his or spent money on his own album. So he had nobody above him, and he happened to blow up with the power of social media. So we already had the exposure side of social media, right? That's pretty Web 2 consistent. We're all very comfortable with it. But nowadays, we're starting to see that artists can say, hey, I'm going to put this music out. I'm going to front load the fundraise, right? I need some money to actually like do the stuff to grow to scale. So what if I sold an NFT that represented the IP of what's going on with my music? And as that revenue stream, the plays start to go out, the album sales increase, everybody that owns a piece of an NFT gets a little bit of slice of that revenue stream, right? And we're starting to see a lot of that. So it's really evolving very quickly.
Yep.
And I think there's even more platforms that are popping up. And, you know, we now have mixtures, right? There's a couple projects that I know you and I own that both have a musical component and an art component. And I think they'll probably have avatars in the metaverse eventually. And obviously that NFT is the ticket to participate.
Yep, exactly. And like, you know, that's a great segue. NFTs can also be used as tickets, right? Because what we're seeing is these musicians or these movie producers, they will, like you said, front load the fundraise by selling NFTs. And these NFTs represent access to benefits down the line once the film or the album is done. So think of a world where a movie studio produces, like they want to produce a slate of films, but they don't have the money to do it. So they do an NFT sale of like the initial artwork. And then if you have that artwork, it gets you a speaking role in the movie, or it gives you access to the first showing, or it gives you access to meet and greet with the actors and actresses. Like those NFTs serve as tickets, and they only belong to the people that buy it. And the authenticity of that NFT is secured by blockchain. You cannot, you know, replicate that NFT. You can't counterfeit it. So that is very, very powerful in the way that creators engage with their communities.
Yeah, I mean, we've even seen, you know, one is called Flyfish Club. Pretty interesting. The art on all of them is identical because in this instance, it's not an art-based NFT. What it does is it gets you into a private restaurant in New York City. It's very akin to the Soho House, right? So the model is already understood, but only NFT holders can get in. So you've got this really cool exclusive event. And the flip side is a couple things. If I'm done with it and I feel, hey, you know, I don't want to participate, or what if the club gets so cool that other people start to offer me so much money I can't say no, I can always flip up my phone, right? I can go through the browser. These crypto wallets actually have a web browser built in, which is super cool. And NFTs got me to use that browser more than my standard one. And all I need to do is interact with my wallet. So maybe another buyer is waiting. And by being in this cool club early, I can turn profit. Aside from that, yep. You know, there's all sorts of financial applications that are coming out, right? Like maybe I rent it. Maybe I know I'm not going to be in the city at that point in time. Someone's going to be there. I could either loan it out and I could actually turn this into a revenue generating asset. Or, you know, I mean, there's a lot more applications coming out. I don't want to go too
deep into it. What's also crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take it away.
What's also crazy is that it's like in that example, right? You are making money by holding an NFT, by being an early supporter. Its value accrues because it got a lot of traction, probably due to you talking about it and you participating in it. But then when you sell it, not only do you benefit, but the restaurant owner also benefits for creating such a dope experience, right? That does not exist in the current world today. Like if I had a VIP pass to a members only restaurant and I sold it to somebody, that transaction is only between me and the person I sold it to. And none of that value gets transferred to the original restaurant owner, which is actually arguably the source of the value, right? So just like wanted to tie that back into something we brought into earlier where it's like, you know, the secondary sales, huge. And it's a huge incentive for the restaurants and also the artists, whoever is creating the NFTs to like continually drive value and increase the value of their NFTs. So it's like a huge incentive alignment that currently does not exist in the market today.
You know, there's even another point just like in there that I would say, which is if I were to sell my VIP ticket, let's say we're not meeting in a dark alley, you know, physically handing it off, probably going through a Web2 company. Again, there's a third party that's trying to extract value somewhere. We see it with Ticketmaster, right? We see it all over the place. And this sort of predatory middleman is always going to be in there taking something. In the crypto world, you know, we still have some of those, like OpenSea does get a cut, but you have LuxRare, which is just a protocol. And it just sits on these trustless blockchains, in this case, Ethereum. So I know that I can open up the internet, I can sell my NFT to Brian on the other side of the world. And in a nutshell, I don't have this third party making a lot of that capital. What gets to be really cool is if we like the protocol, you and I might also own some stakeable assets. Maybe we provide liquidity for a lot of that movement for that capital market to get deep to actually function. And we might even get paid for every single transaction going on there. So what's really cool about blockchain technology is none of this exists in a bubble. The NFT world started with these single collectibles, but then people build protocols to take advantage of those to maybe unlock some of their value. We're starting to see, again, rental ones where maybe you could rent it out to anybody who pays for a little bit of time. Let's say it's a piece of art. We've seen projects that if you want to put it up on a screen at a party, you know, you could rent it. So my piece of art, my collectible, would be in some billionaire's mansion, and he pays me for the right to put up the original piece for a little while. This could be going to museums, right? You don't actually have to ship the thing. They want to know that it's an original because the museum's not interested in a copy of facsimile. So they know that from the blockchain, they're putting up the OG source, the original, and they're going to pay you for that. So you sit back, these things become, again, new mechanisms of transmitting value. And maybe I want that in some sort of fungible. Maybe I immediately want it to come back into like a plasma sword. Again, it's really going to be whatever. When money just becomes this digital, highly transactable thing, I think we will all find our own little baskets where we're comfortable, where we prefer our value to be held. So that's where it gets really interesting.
I mean, I totally agree. I think like to your point that I always, you know, hear, which is like money may not be money anymore. Money currently is just a medium of exchange for us to get what we want. But if we can go directly to what we want, because everything on blockchain is can be transacted trustlessly, then we don't need the money part because we just skip that step. We leapfrog it. So yeah, I'm super into that. There's already, you know, probably when we start talking more about DeFi, we'll get into like ways that these protocols allow you to trade between different asset classes through wrapped assets, through derivatives and synthetics and things like that. So people can just get what they want without going to something like USD. So NFTs are just one part of that whole equation. So yeah, it's super fascinating stuff. And I think that, you know, the ability for the user or the community member to not only participate in owning and buying and selling the NFT, but also participating in the ecosystem in which the NFT is being hosted on, like, that's just like mind blowing. And this just goes back to just like how it's flipping the entire industry on its head, where there's no middlemen, there is no trusted third party, and it's all just executed through code. So because of that, you know, the ownership lies within the community members, and the community members are directly incentivized to support this protocol, whatever it is that they're being involved in. So I think that this, to me, it means that there's like longevity in the protocol and also incentivization in the community to continue to like support it, which is, I think, something that's kind of lacking today in like traditional Web 2.
Yeah. And, you know, on a final note, I'll just add that because it is blockchain, geography doesn't matter. Age doesn't really matter. No matter who you are, you can fire up a MetaMask account. It's not as arduous as opening a bank account. And basically it's just entirely open, right? Accessibility is unparalleled.
100%. It's completely open. Like, doesn't matter. You just need internet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you just need internet and then you're in.
And with that, we'll say that the internet is also starting to become a mesh network. There's lots of different possibilities where maybe we don't rely on the internet service providers. That's going to be for another episode. Awesome, Brian. I think that about wraps up, you know, NFTs for now. We'll definitely return to this topic because it is evolving so quickly that probably by the time this airs, there will be two or three new protocols that are doing something completely mind-bending. And can't wait to see what they are.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. And I appreciate your presence. It's always a blast chatting.
Always. Thank you, Graham.
ERC is an acronym that stands for Ethereum Request for Comments. ERCs are application level standards for Ethereum and can include token standards, name registries, library package formats, and more. One of the earliest and most prominent forms of NFTs are the ERC-721 standard. According to Ethereum.org, we considered the use cases of NFTs being owned and transacted by individuals, as well as consignment to third-party brokers, wallets, operators. NFTs can represent ownership over digital or physical assets. We considered a diverse universe of assets, and we know that you'll dream up more. Physical property, like houses and unique artwork, virtual collectibles, like unique pictures of kittens, collectible cards, negative value assets, like loans, burdens, and other responsibilities. Hey, everybody. I'm pretty excited to have an interview here with Michael George, partner at Wave 7 and co-founder of Wagney Beach and the Catalina Whale Mixer, a PFP project on Solana that's been having a really great time and building a super strong community. So welcome, Mike. Michael, it's a pleasure to have you here. Just take a second to say hello.
Graham, thanks for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
Absolutely. So I really wanted to get into this. I think one of the fun things about what you've built is that the community does seem to be resonating, right? I go on Twitter. There's a slogan in the whale community, pow, pow. Everybody's waking up, you know, they're tossing it out there. You've been building really excellent video content around the entire idea. And, you know, just really wanted to pick your brain a little bit. Like, did you even have any blockchain or engineering experience before you kicked this off? Or like, how did the initial steps in the idea come together for creating this project?
Yeah, so basically about, let's call it 18 months, maybe it's a little shy. We started a principal back fund known as Wave 7. It has five principal partners that are all veterans in the music and entertainment industry who have all, whether they've, you know, worked at tech companies where they, you know, were directly responsible for building community and onboarding new user adoption, or myself, I worked for the better part of the last decade with Scooter Braun, where I managed Martin Garrix, as well as Eden. And then Carlo, Josh, and Ben, they run an independent distribution company and management business known as Independent. And basically, we started this fund. We start mainly because we realized like we were never going to be great traders, but we have one unique value add, or one main unique value add, which is we've spent our entire career helping founders, if you just replace the word founder with artist, right? So we basically apply those same principles that we have to artists over the course of our career to founders, and it made a lot of sense. A lot of founders really liked us. They liked our ideas. Our network was unique. You know, our addition to the cap table wasn't so tremendous and prohibitive on a monetary number. So, you know, we started building this fund, and we just became super bullish on Solana and the Solana ecosystem because we feel like it has the power to give kind of blockchain that iPhone moment, as Carlo loves to say, where essentially, you know, everyone kind of realizes like, whoa, this doesn't have to be that hard or that complicated. And, you know, we can do this with and achieve mass consumer adoption. So around in the summer of last year, I think we had invested in Saber at that point. And once you mess with Saber, coming from Ethereum, it's kind of, you have that aha light bulb moment. And from there, at least Carlo and I like loaded up Solana bags. And then next thing you know, you're just degenning across the NFT ecosystem, right? And quickly those Solana bags disappeared and they became all JPEGs, right? And some were cool winners and tons of them were losers, but we were like entrenched and addicted to what was happening on Solana. And that was kind of the moment for Carlo and I, where we realized that, you know, there's a direct parallel between the ease of use and low fees associated with Solana and the quality of projects that come out there. Basically, when you strip the barrier to entry away, you just have a huge influx of volume. And, you know, with that volume comes questionable quality and questionable utility and questionable actors and so on and so forth. So while we do believe in the Solana ecosystem, you know, wholeheartedly, we also believe that it was like very similar to the music industry with the advent of digital recording technology and digital distribution. You kind of need a playlist, right? I need a place to go pay attention. And so that was kind of the brainchild behind Wag Me Beach, which is like this parent company that will essentially help bless and put out new projects in the Solana ecosystem that you'll always know are up to a certain level of quality, certain standard, as well as have like, you know, teams that have either executed and built outside of Web3 and we're helping usher them in or whatever it might be. And then, yeah, so, okay, you have those ideas and then what comes next? What comes next is you got to figure out what your first project's going to be. And we had tons of different ideas that were like kind of silly. And then, but whales were something we just kept coming back to. It was like, you know, what is part of the crypto zeitgeist that is a word that we all use all the time? And it's also an aspirational word, right? Like everybody wants to be a whale. You know, I guess like aping around is exciting and cool, but it's like, I don't know that I'm dying to be an ape, right? I want to be a whale. So we were brainstorming. And then, you know, what's like a good way to call it a project about whales. And that was kind of, it was, I remember where I was and it was just, you know, remembered that classic scene in Step Brothers called the Catalina Wine Mixer and how they were always building towards that. And I was like, wait, it's the Catalina Whale Mixer. You know what I mean? And then I called everybody and everyone was like, holy shit, like we did it. Like now it's a brand, you know, now you have something you build around. Yeah, sorry, that was like a long history, but I think that gives you like a good foundation of like the project, us and our history, as well as like, you know, what kind of got us excited about, you know, even at the base level of like the name and how we think about these things. It's not, you can't take all this lightly. I field a lot of phone calls that are like, hey, how come my project isn't doing that well, et cetera. And it's a lot of times it comes down to that inherent, you know, missing that branding link, right? Missing that like ability to actually, some people like someone in Web3 already, and they're like, we launched this NFT project. Why isn't it doing that well? And I was like, I'll go look. And I'm like, well, it's really confusing because you run this protocol, but like all your tweets are about this NFT project. And how does that make any sense? Like, if you want to launch an NFT project, that needs its own voice, it needs its own brand, and it shouldn't be tweeted from the main account all the time because it's just confusing your brand messaging.
You know, it's funny, in Web3, we see a lot of people coming from the software space, right? And software can often break off products into new products, right? Spin things out. Software can also be repaired when it's live, which is a little bit different with crypto because, you know, you're dealing with capital. It's almost got like hardware in that regards, but a lot of people do seem to get confused. It's my personal take that if you do want to launch a project in this space, you have to view it as an independent company, really needs its own CEO, and obviously it needs its own branding. But that being said, like, you've got the idea, you've got the brand, it's all really solid. What are the building blocks that you need? Obviously there's like art involved. How did you figure out how to code these things to do the distribution? What are like the base level steps to launching?
My go-to method, even as a manager, is to never like try to be the pro at everything. You know, like I want to lean on and trust other pros and basically put my life in their hands, right? So we did a bunch of research and we reached out to tons of people, and we ended up with this designer named Moko, who is fantastic. And Moko worked with us from the original drawings for what a whale, you know, a degenny whale, right, look like, were so goofy. And it took, you know, and then it kind of looked like a frog, and like, it kind of just like, and then it finally evolved into this hero image that we were like, oh, that's it. Right. But, you know, each step of the way, at least on the art side, I think, you know, the words of wisdom I can give are like, don't get discouraged right away with what the initial product looks like. It's similar when you get a demo from a band or whatever it is, you have to work with them to get it to be the place that you're happy with. And also don't rush it. That was like a almost 3-month process, I think, you know, and we were down to the wire with attributes, deciding the Monday or Tuesday of that week, what was going to be included and not included, to the behest of our developer. So after you lock in your designer, you know, the next most important part is marketing and actually finding a dev, right? You know, I got lucky. I was at a holiday dinner. You know, people were talking about Web3. My wife's friend's husband called me 3 days later and was like, you know, I've been like working at the NFL for this long, and I'm a consultant for all these companies, and this is what I do. Like, I brought companies into Web1, and then from Web1 into Web2. And then I bought Bitcoin super early and Ethereum super early. And then I sold at the wrong time. And, you know, and I've basically been jaded and don't want to get back involved. But the way you spoke about it, I want in. And so Arshad came to the table as our dev and basically just self-taught himself, you know, all the things he would need to know about Candy Machine, all the things he would need to know about generative art and so on. He had already known a lot because he's kind of an artist and a creative in himself. And so he had always done like cool different projects before this space ever took off. And so we locked in Arshad. And then my buddy Alec was an incredible marketing exec at Interscope, who had just left his job, and also was worked with me while I worked with Scooter, and where he managed Lil Dicky and a bunch of other acts. And, you know, Alec has this like uncanny way with words that is like, it's really, really special and unique. He's like the person you call when you need an Instagram caption. You know what I mean? like Alec will just say it and you'll be like, damn, like that's so much better than anything I came up with. So like when you read our Twitter and you read the way he writes announcements, I think he's really that voice of this brand is so key. And Alec early on had an idea for gating the Discord, which was a big marketing tactic that we employed early, where basically we thought about, you know,
what does gating the Discord mean?
So basically we, you know, let's talk about, there's a dating app called Raya, right? And Raya was super exclusive and you could only get invited by someone who had an invite. And then there was Clubhouse, same thing, super exclusive. And you could only get an invite by inviting a couple of your friends. So Alec basically was like, yo, let's flip our Discord into Clubhouse or Raya, so to speak, right? Let's get in all the people we want in, and then let's let them each have 5 invites. And that's kind of what we did. And it went nuts. Like it was wild because it went nuts and then it dropped off. But like in the first 5 days, it was 1,000 people. And we knew that there were only people that were being invited by other people, which was so badass, right? Sorry, marketing, art, dev, all those things were, you know, brought in-house from people in our network or people that we, you know, ended up being in our network.
All right, cool. Now, when you launched, did you think about putting utility behind it versus it just being pure pieces of art? And how do you view sort of, I guess, what you're doing with the whales versus the industry at large as well, just in terms of utility and art?
I mean, I have a lot of opinions on this, some of which may, you know, controversial, so to speak, but I think there's a couple of things I think. One, I think a lot of roadmaps that are released early and a bunch of utility sometimes are really convincing someone to part with their hard-earned Solana or Ethereum, but they might not actually, like, I don't know that they matter, right? Like the truth is the same way, I mean, Graham, right? Like as Republic Crypto, you guys will look into tons of different factors when you're deciding who you're going to invest in, right? And a good idea is really important, but a good team is like 10 times more important. And so I think a lot of times these ideas and these roadmaps and these utilities are actually just a way, sometimes, I'm not saying all the time, but to disguise like that you're investing in an anon that you don't know, to disguise that you don't know someone's history. Whereas like, you know, we were fully doxed. Our experience is right there on the paper. And to me, we actually didn't come with a roadmap. The real utility that we've always pitched since day one was you will have access to all the future WAGMI Beach drops, meaning you'll have, let's say, whitelist spots or whatever it might be. That's the main utility. And we didn't even tell them what those drops might be. I'm not saying you can get away with this now, but that, you know, I just think when roadmap all the time, or these guys don't even have a roadmap, yeah, that's okay. You're betting on us. And you're betting on like this overall thought that we are like going to build a brand with this and rip it to the cultural zeitgeist with haste, which is like the goal. And so those are my high level thoughts on utilities and roadmaps. I think they're, you know, I heard this secondhand, but I wasn't in the room. But it's funny because a bunch of big people who are ETH collectors and people who've launched ETH projects, they were all debating like utility versus not utility. And someone jumped up and was like, I wish we had less utility because we have so much utility and they have no utility and they just keep going up. I hate to say it, but like at the end of the day, a lot of people or the people in the Discord who are like moon boys, right? All they're thinking about is when number go up. They ask you when roadmap, all they're saying is like, what is raising the floor? They don't actually care about utility. They just care that the number goes up. So it's kind of this like, you know, I think it's really important for founders to not get distracted by the voices in the room that are not your core team. I think it's good to take their opinions in, but same with an artist, right? How many times I've launched a tour and everyone says, but how come not my city, right? Or how many times we put out a song and they said, oh, but what about this one that I heard you play at that show? I'm sorry, like we have to do what we know is right and deliver it when we know it's right versus listening to everyone. You can't like, I guess it goes back to the DAO thing, but it's like, it's really tough in theory to have like an incredible product where you're constantly governing by committee, right? And then the only other thing that I think is, I have a touch of a problem with is emissions tokens for staking that either have no real practical use case or really don't matter. And they happen right away, the moment you get your PFP project and so many people love it. And they're like, oh my God, I'm staking and it makes it illiquid and the floor goes up and so on and so forth. I just have a lot of trouble imagining a world where 99% of those tokens on the other, like don't go to zero. I don't know who is buying that token on the other side of that trade. And that's where I get hung up on all the time, because people are like, how come we can't stake the whales and get this? It's like, because bro, I better have like the world's greatest idea for why you're going to need this token. Otherwise, I'm giving you something that's worthless, and someone else's poor person is paying for something that's worthless and giving you liquidity. And I just hate it. It makes me like feel uncomfortable.
Absolutely. I would say, just when looking at any token in general, a really solid rule of thumb, and this is why our first question to any new founder is like, why a token? Is, can you remove the token from the ecosystem? And then if the ecosystem continues to maintain itself without a token, then maybe it doesn't need one. If you pull it out and suddenly the whole ecosystem collapses, then okay, that thing is pretty fundamental and it's something to look at. I do need to put in a quick disclaimer that Republic Crypto does not actually place investments into any companies. That comes from Republic Capital, a separate company. So one thing, you know, for people that might be watching this and they're like, I kind of want to, you know, pull a page from your playbook, and you're talking about the private Discord, but you're also, you know, having this open conversation with community, but truly following your own heart, which I think is wise. How did you manage the Discord, and like how active, right? Like what does the touch point look like with the community in the Discord?
Yeah. So basically we have, early on before the launch, we only had, this one incredible Discord mod named Mookie, as well as Alec. Alec were really in there. And then myself and Carlo, right? We were the ones being the most active. Mookie, bar none. You know, before launch and after launch are two different beasts. Before launch, you're basically quelling FUD and trying to like make conversations happen and hoping you meet cool people, and cool people are getting excited by new marketing materials. And then post launch, it's kind of the same thing where you're quelling FUD because people just want to jump in here and be afraid. But also now you have like a real community of people who care. And I've noticed that when I just jump in there and chat, even if it's a few minutes a day or 10 minutes, you know, cumulative throughout the day, people are jumping right back to me. They've got thoughts. Hey, did you guys tackle this? Hey, what's going on with this? Yo, did you see this? Hey, by the way, I work at X, Y, and Z, and I have some opinions. By the way, I have this, this, and this. And I've taken like, you know, I've had a bunch of really incredible phone calls with people from our community who are, you know, run different businesses and, you know, love the whales and want to be more and more involved. So yeah, it's, I don't necessarily know what the right answer is of like how often to not, you know, with us, right? We've been vague for a long time about a roadmap, but we have plans. And the reason we've been vague is because when you try to execute high level partnerships, you can't put the cart before the horse. I can't announce a partnership or say a partnership and then blow up the partnership just because the Discord keeps asking me when roadmap, right? Yeah. And if the big pieces of the roadmap are these, you know, partnerships or what we plan on building, and we don't want to give it all away, it's kind of this like chicken or an egg scenario. So to be fair, we have noticed, I guess, a backlash in the community wanting more clarity, despite the one-on-one phone calls we have with people. Everybody else wants to be included and know. And then to us, it's really how you don't give away everything while also giving away enough while also not being vague. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a very tricky scenario. So we're at this moment where I think we're going to put out like, we're brainstorming this. And I don't know when this comes out, so maybe people will know or not know before, but you know, we're thinking about, we're definitely going to come with a roadmap. People will have clarity. We might redact the actual partnerships that we have planned. So it actually leads to like a future, you know, mysterious future announcement drops, mysterious, while giving you, you know, the info and feedback that you want or need right now. But, you know, like I said, I think a lot of the when this, when that all stems from a couple things. A, they want the floor to go up, and B, they're also like looking at other projects and thinking, damn, that guy ripped up, and why didn't we rip up? And I could have been invested in that one. You know, oh, look at all the things they're doing. Everybody's on their own path to this stuff. Everybody grows at their own rate. Some of the projects we get compared to are 6 months older than us. So it's just like, you know, give us a moment. At any given day, we're trading between, you know, at the very, very lowest that happens for like 1 or 2 days, will be 7 times the mint price. And then normally we sit around 11 to 13 times the mint price. So it's, you know, it's really people who bought in at the highest of the highs at a different moment that are in there more active. The rest of them are just like, when it drops to 7 or 8 sol, we're going to go buy some more because we trust Mike. We trust Carlo. We trust Alec. We know the team. Like, we don't know everything that they're doing, but we know whatever they're doing is pretty tight.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you talked about hopping in the Discord for even 10 minutes and having authentic conversations. This is honestly something I tell people over and over again. You know, this space has unfettered access to the teams, right? It's usually the Discord. It's like, hey, you know, if you want to get a job, just start talking to these people. And I think that there's really nothing better than just organic conversation to see that there's a legit human on the other side of this, let alone somebody that's engaging and interesting rather than a scammer who might be like, you know, the token price is going to moon. Don't worry, stick with me. I always get the most from just having a completely human conversation. I think that applies beyond the NFT space, and it's one of the more interesting things in Web3, just to know that, you know, there's a real team there. So anyway, with that being said, I think I want to take us out on a high note, if you're all right with that. Catalina Whale Mixers is known on Twitter for putting out these really fantastic animations of classic movies in which you replace the whales with the main characters. I think they're hysterical. Every time they drop, it's just like,
thank you.
The commitment into this is really fantastic. They're sort of like an inside joke, because you've even told me that not everyone in the community is aware of some of these films. Maybe they're, you know, more millennial or above, and like, you know, there's a lot of Gen Z in there. But I would just love to hear the backstory of how you've landed on these little clips and how they came to be.
We started with the inspiration from Step Brothers, and there's just so much comedy gold there. And a lot of times, you know, there's one really funny one we have up somewhere where people constantly were asking us, like, when roadmap before we put it out. And there's a scene in Step Brothers where they do this like prestige worldwide, where they're like doing this whole bit about investing in them, and they're going to throw all these events. And so I, you know, obviously we work in music, so I know voice actors, et cetera. And I called someone and I said, look, here's a script. And essentially this, I made a joke. Like I basically parodied the whole thing and was like, you know, basically like made fun of the fact that we don't have a roadmap, right? Like it was just like, you know, what are we doing? Oh, black leather gloves and blah, 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 blah. Like totally makes no sense. And then just, we posted that on Twitter with like, you guys asked for a roadmap, here it is. And honestly, man, we've just been having so much fun with that. It allows your imagination to go like absolutely crazy. It allows your creativity to be really crazy and fun. I don't see it stopping at any point. I think it's actually a good like, huh, wow, look at what they're doing with animation here. I wonder where this thing goes, right? It's all like kind of leading towards where I want this to go without saying it, to, you know. And so, yeah, they are the most fun thing ever. The Godfather's one was great. The Sopranos one I love.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, they're just so fun. And they're really good ways to like communicate a new message. Yeah, I think the biggest and best one we ever did was that the one at the Pow Pow Lounge where we had like all of the we ripped on the Goodfellas intro where it's like meet the mob or meet the crew or whatever, and we pulled in like Soul Big Brain and Alpha Dog, and yeah, dude, I don't know, they're the best and most fun. And I got to give a big shout out to Moco. You know, when we started this, right, we didn't know each other, and now Moco, Carlo, Alec, and I talk all day, every day. And Moco is actually just a magician. You know, like he can take an idea that I have, which is sometimes abstract, or sometimes I'll draw something, or, you know, maybe I'll send a video link or whatever. And he'll always tell me, yeah, I could get that done in like 5 days. And then I swear to God, he'll send me something in 3 hours every time. And he's just a beast, man. He makes it all possible.
Good teams make dreams. All right. Well, if anyone wants to check out these whales, where can they find them?
Magic Eden is the move. That's where the most liquidity is. That's where you can see them. You can find us at Catalina Whales on IG, at Catalina Whales on Twitter. I believe we're at Catalina Whales on TikTok as well. But yeah, that's where you can come and find us. And I am at Mr_George on Twitter if you want to say hey.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time, Mike. And look forward to following everything that goes on with the Catalina Whale Mixer.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate you, as always.
All right.
This podcast is provided for educational purposes only by Opendeal Inc., DBA Republic, and Republic Court LLC, collectively Republic. Nothing discussed should be construed as legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. The views of the presenters may not be the views of Republic and its affiliates. Always consult with trusted professional advisors before making investments. Private investments are inherently illiquid and may result in total loss. No broker, dealer, funding portal, or investment advisor participated in the creation or distribution of this content. All rights reserved.